The very definition of economic rationality is that we should be able to produce more with less. But what the reality in the socialist economy is that they produce less with more, which meant that they were getting poorer over time, right? Which it goes back to why it is they can't achieve their goals of prosperity and equality.
Understand more about what life was like in socialist societies, how they started down a path towards socialism, and what factors made them decide to end their experiment with central planning. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Peter Betke. Pete Betke is a distinguished university professor of economics and philosophy at George Mason University, as well as the director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Pete is also the author of several books on history, collapse, and transition from socialism in the former Soviet Union. He's written books such as The Political Economy of Soviet Socialism, The Formative Years, Why Perestroika Failed, and today we're going to be talking about his work on Estonia. So Pete, thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge with us today. I'm really excited. You are one of the experts on Soviet post-transition economies. And so I really appreciate you speaking with us.
I'm thrilled to be here with you, Rosie. And I love this project that Fraser has engaged in with the realities of socialism. I loved writing the books with Matt Mitchell and my former student now, young professor, Konstantin Zhukov. And it was a great experience, great learning experience to dive both feet back into the field of this. So just thrilled to be here.
Because this is where your career started.
Yep. It was how I started. I didn't plan on doing this, but I'm wearing my Grove City sweatshirt. But it was actually at Grove City College that I got very interested. And, in these issues and in particular economics applied to understanding, it was the late 70s, early 80s. There was a lot going on, obviously, and the U.S. economy was in malaise. So it brought a lot of people interest in economics. But also remember that there was heightened, Cold War kind of issues. As I always like to remind people, the police and Sting sang a song, about, we hope that Americans realize that the Russians love their children too, and all these things, because there was always these battles. Ted Turner on CNN Turner Network had a show from, Moscow to Vladivostok, to try to show you on a train ride, what life was like in the Soviet Union. But you also have to contrast that with Rambo, right? Where Sylvester Stallone's taking down, the Soviet MiGs fighting in the Middle East and, whatnot. And also Rocky, where he fights, over in the Soviet Union and all of that stuff. So all of that was going on. And so I got very interested in trying to use economic tools to answer questions that were battlegrounds in history. That's actually what was going on, is there's these contrasts between the different historians about what they would interpret what was going on. And I was trying to use economics to resolve debates in history. And so that's how my career started. Yeah.
And that makes you the perfect person to talk about Estonia with us. I'm really excited about the Estonian story because it's really a comeback story, right? It's really hopeful. So I can't wait to dig in. And before we get started, I would like you to kind of define what you mean by socialism for listeners, especially people who might have just stumbled on this podcast for the first time. I want to make sure we're all on the same page about what that means.
Yeah, so the way that we go about it in the book is we talk about the idea of state ownership of the means of production, basically. So government control of the economy. And then, you know, the stage to move beyond that was, as socialism would mature, the theory went that the state would wither away and then you would have communism. But what we're really talking about here is government control of the economy, mainly through some form of planning of the economy by, you know, government officials. And then that's kind of what all of these, that's why nationalization is part of this. And, you know, and yeah. And so that's kind of what we're getting at here. In earlier, in other podcasts, I've really stressed this issue that I think that you have to realize that modifiers. So let me just take two issues for your young readers. Modifiers like democratic socialism don't do the job that some young people think they do today. Because if you go back in history, the term Soviet actually is, you know, the worker councils. And the term Bolshevik means majority, right? Menshevik means minority. They were social democratic. They were a version of the social democratic party. And so, you know, even the most extreme forms of socialism that people look at and say, oh, we don't want that now because we want democratic socialism. If you look at their origins, they in fact called themselves democratic socialists. They were the first real Democrats, as opposed to bourgeois democracy, which of course was controlled by the moneyed interests and things like that, which is the same argument that people give today. And so and to give one more example, in Britain, the rise of what was called the theory of market socialism was driven by the economists over there. That was really an economics movement, market socialism. But they said, listen, we're socialists in our economics because we're liberal Democrats in our politics. And so part of Hayek's warning in The Road to Serfdom is you can't square that. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't work. And so you might want them to happen. That's why The Road to Serfdom is a sincere book. That's a tragic story. And it's dedicated to socialists of all parties. That's not him being snarky, like, you know, hey, I'm going to make fun of you or something. No, he was sincere that the greatest tragedy that could happen is people seeking their highest ideals end up by creating the very opposite of what they'd like to achieve. And right. So I think telling that lesson to young people about modifiers like democratic socialism is, you know, is very important. The other part is about technology. So not, a lot of times today we hear about, oh, technology has caught up, supercomputers or whatever. And one of the things I like to point out is that throughout the history of socialist planning, they have constantly pointed to the new technologies to solve their issues. You're an economist. So it's easy for you to see this because a lot of times they were tools in economics. So it was, you know, social welfare functions, right? I'm going to use those. I'm going to use linear programming. Mm-hmm. The origins of econometrics, where I'm going to use econometrics to plan the economy.
And now we have big data and, right. And now large it's big language data. Models and complicated and, algorithms.
Right. And the thing is that from the very beginning, socialism was always techno-socialism because it was ever whatever the latest technology was going to be deployed in order to make the planning efficient. And so, again, it's not like anything new. I mean, again, you know, Kantorovich won the Nobel Prize for the development of linear programming. That was done in the Soviet Union. Leontief won the Nobel Prize for input-output tables, in which he was using matrix algebra, right? This is all of these various different, you know, techniques were used. So right now we're using supercomputers and big data, but it's just another, you know, manifestation of the same thing we've been doing all along. So a lot of the criticisms, the point about this is that a lot of the criticisms in the history are as relevant today as they were when they were written. And so the young people need to study the history in order to be able to understand where we're at today and what challenges would be met. And I think this is one of the real benefits of this project that's going on.
Yes. And you set this up so nicely because I would like to hear a little bit about Estonia's case, a little bit about its history and how it started on its experiment with socialism to begin with.
Yeah. So let me just state before we get started is that one of the great thrills of my life was because of a program that I worked with the Fund for American Studies, and I taught over in Eastern Europe, is I got to meet Marlar, you know, years and years ago. And because he was at their graduation ceremony at Charles University in Prague, he was the commencement speaker. So I got to go to lunch with him before and, you know, sit with him and talk or whatever. Just an amazingly inspiring guy, but also extremely like, you know, like down to earth, humble, right? That kind of guy. Not at all like a lot of politicians that you meet that are very, you know, fancy or whatever. He was just a really, you know, he's a high school history teacher, basically, right? And you know, he was he's just a good guy, and he was such a dedicated and strong believer. And we'll get to him later on. But I do think one of the things, which again is weird for you and I as economists, is that what transitions teach us is just like in the economy where you need to have entrepreneurs, in these kind of policy shifts, you need to have pivotal people at pivotal times. And leadership does matter. Our models as economists are to try to eliminate all that stuff, right? And just talk about the systematic forces. But there are people that matter. And so, history matters.
And social entrepreneurs. And culture matters, which is right. One of the things that you talk a lot about in this.
It's going to play a big role here, right, actually. So I would say the following thing about Estonia and their experience with socialism is that Estonia, like, Lithuania and Latvia, they're these Baltic countries. They're the gateway to Europe. So they're control group in many ways is like Finland and Sweden and stuff, as opposed to, let's say, Russia or whatever, right? But so they're more Western Europe than they are Eastern Europe in that regard. And they had a strong, you know, movement towards trying to escape from Tsarist Russia and an independence movement. And they've had these little pockets of independence. And then what happened was they got hit by a 1-2 punch, which was that the communists took over, and then the Nazis defeated the communists, and they eliminated kind of an independent Lithuania. And so you have this issue in which you have Nazi occupation followed by then or communist occupation, then followed by Nazi occupation, then the defeat. And the Nazi occupation was due to a unholy pact, you know, between Stalin and Hitler that divided up Europe, basically. And Estonia was given over to them. The Baltic states was given over to the communists. But then, to the Nazis. And then the Nazis were defeated by the communists. And then you end up by having the long rule of communist rule after World War II with Estonia. And so Estonia has these little pockets of independence, sort of liberalism in some form or another relative to the others. But they are, just defeated by, as we refer to it in the book, the two wolves, right, that affect them. And that has a huge impact on their history, their understanding, and their culture of themselves.
So during that transition to or socialism, was it abrupt or was it a slower process? Like, what did that look like?
So what I'm trying to say is that socialism really wasn't indigenous to the Estonian people. It was an imposed thing. I got the story a little convoluted in the past, but you know, it's basically this, they become a tool of what might be called political football during the interwar years. And that is a serious issue, but it's not like they have an indigenous culture, which is inherently socialistic. And that means that when the transition to socialism came, you know, what happened was the Nazis take over. And then when the communists defeat the Nazis, it's not like the Nazi policies were not also socialist policies. So, you know, the economy just is controlled by the government that's imposing itself and using Estonia's economy for purposes outside of the Estonian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Estonia has relatively more gateway to Europe than other Soviet, you know, aligned nations. And so as a result, they you know, they were relatively wealthier than the rest of the Soviet republics. But they still had to, they were under the thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's economically, politically, and also culturally, because the big movement was Russification. And that's a big part of the story in the end, is that they tried to impose Russian culture
right.
on the Estonian people and suppress their Estonian history and their Estonian culture. And that was one of the things that they fought back against, you know, after 1989.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just back up a second, just to highlight a point. That's a very important point of the history, which is when Gorbachev becomes the head of the Politburo, he pursues a policy path called perestroika, which is restructuring of the economy, mm-hmm. and glasnost, which means public frankness. And so finally, they were going to start telling the truth about history. Telling the truth so much of that, in 1987, they actually canceled the high school history exams throughout the Soviet Union because they didn't know what the right history was to teach. So they had to cancel the exams. As one of those issues, they had to come to grips and recognize that the Stalin-Hitler pact was, in fact, illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And that pact, part of it was to the annexation of, you know, the Baltic states in the dividing up. OK. And so therefore, they didn't belong to the Soviet Union. And so the Baltic states all celebrated and said, hey, yeah, okay, good, you know. And so there used to be a Soviet joke that in 1956, when the Hungarians wanted to be free, Khrushchev sent in the tanks. In 1969, when the Czechs wanted to be free, you know, Brezhnev sent in the tanks. In 1987, when the Baltic states wanted to be free, Gorbachev sent in the accountants, because Gorbachev's response was, oh, yes, you're independent, but you owe us money for all the infrastructure development that we had given you and stuff. And so they were like, no, you owe us because you occupied us and we didn't ask to be occupied. And so they had this battle going on. Now, I'm being a little flippant with it. It gets very, very nasty. And this is one of the things that, Gorbachev is often viewed as this, you know, sort of just peaceful kind of guy. But he actually sent in paratroopers to suppress mm-hmm. the independence movement in the Baltic states because they weren't listening. They weren't going to back down. And so that's all prior to 1989 that's all going on. And once you get to 1989, then, you know, and further on, you know, Gorbachev does not send in the tanks in East Germany. He doesn't, you know, so he you know, what happens is the systems all start to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so going back to your first question, which was there transition to socialism, you know, gradual or whatever? No, it was imposed on them.
Mm-hmm.
And their transition to the market was just as, and not imposed, but just as much a choice of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they just move quicker and more radical than any of the other countries, actually.
Mm-hmm. That time when it was kind of a back and forth, that had to have created quite a bit of uncertainty living under that kind of regime.
Yeah, I mean, it's, unbelievable. In all of these periods of time, tremendous resiliency of the Estonian people. bravery, you know, as I'm sure you're going to ask me about with the singing revolution and all this.
I can't help but ask about the singing revolution.
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's just an amazing act of defiance and nonviolent resistance, actually. So very, very important, you know, part of the story.
So you had mentioned that Estonia was kind of wealthier than some of the other Soviet nations. What happened to their economy, their living standards during this time when they were living under socialism?
Okay, so that's important because during their relative independence, they are actually better off than Finland. Mm-hmm. So we have this data, we show like their growth rates, all sort of standard economic measures. And Finland is here and Estonia is like here, right? And what happens is because of the socialist policies, Finland grows and Estonia stagnates, right? And mm-hmm. So what happens is Finland is far superior to Estonia, even though Estonia is better than other communist, Soviet bloc areas. Finland is so much better. And then in the post, period, what happens is Estonia catches up, you know, to Finland. And it's an amazing story to just look at that kind of development, because if you go back to the earlier period and you look, Finland is, you know, I don't know if your listeners have watched it, but I recommend it to everyone, is to watch this Hans Riesling, 200 countries over 200 years in 4 minutes. And I love when he points out that, you know, the world was poor and sick, and we were all clustered down there in the poor and sick. And then what happens since the Industrial Revolution is some countries end up by becoming in the healthy and wealthy section over here or whatever. And other ones, you know, have shifted to the middle, right? So there's more middle income countries, but there still is the tragedy of some people still trapped in the poor and sick region. Well, what happened is, you know, at the time that we're looking at in the early part of the 20th century, you know, Finland and Estonia, they're in that poor and sick area, both of them mm-hmm. are, right? So it's not like, you know, either one of them was the UK or, you know, even, you know, Germany or, you know, that level, France or the United States for that matter, you know, level of economic growth. But they were down here in the poor and sick version. But in that region, Finland was better off, you know, by quite a bit than Estonia. Excuse me, Estonia was better off than quite a bit by Finland. But Finland migrates into that because of economic freedom, relative economic freedom. They're able to actually move into the healthy and wealthy. But Estonia was trapped because of communism down in here. Mm-hmm. All right. And so that's the sort of, so the way to think about it is in the Hans Riesling video, when he shows China, mm-hmm. he like takes the different bubbles to break it down even further. Right. And he says, so like, if you look at Guangdong, you know, Guangdong goes all the way up here because it's growing like, you know, the fastest countries in the world. But then you take this, you know, province down here and it actually ends up by being like, not quite, but sub-Saharan Africa or something. Right. Right? And I think that's the way to think about the Soviet Union. And when you push the button for Estonia, it will go up here. And what's the thesis for that is it's relatively more open to trade and whatnot. And therefore, it's a gateway to Europe. And that's also true for the transition of ideas, as well as for, you know, resources and whatnot. And so, you know, there it's a constrained economy, but nevertheless, it's closer to Europe than it is to, you know, so it, what's its distance between, you know, Western Europe and what's its distance to, you know, say, Eastern Europe? How do I measure those? Estonia is a little closer over here. So it was mm-hmm. a little better off than the others.
Now, did the Soviets hold Estonia up as like an example of communism working, since it was doing better than some of the other Soviet states?
That's a kind of an interesting question, right? I mean, yes and no, because they wanted to make sure their thumb was on it culturally, right? Sure. So, in the propaganda wars, it's not like they held them out in any particular case. Uh-huh. So in the propaganda wars, you still would have been much more located in the center city of Moscow would have been. Yeah.
Okay.
But I do think, so this is terrible at some level, but I do think Gorbachev's biggest mistake for the sustaining of the Soviet Union, if like that was the goal, mm-hmm. was that what he should have done is he should have turned the Baltic states into a Hong Kong and just made them a free trade zone. And that would have enabled him to, from their surplus, maintain the Soviet Union for at least another decade or so, right? Or who knows, you know, farther along. But they chose not to do that strategy, you know, but that could have been one of the strategies that they could have done, turn those into a free trade zone and then live off the surplus of that. Because they would have opened up all of that to Europe, would have been pretty amazing, actually.
Well, kind of thankful that he didn't think of that.
Only an economist would think of that. That's the issue.
I hope no budding authoritarian leader is listening.
Yeah. You and me both.
But perhaps, Estonia's position, their relative openness to the rest of the Soviet states, did that kind of sow the seed for the undoing of socialism as well?
I think that, so let me see if I can sort of take a little bit of a stab at this, because I think there's an interconnectedness between the sort of hard-nosed economics and the broader issues of culture and history and whatnot as it goes. And the way that goes is that socialism faces fundamental problems that allow it to not be able to achieve its outcomes with the means by which it chooses to do things. Mm-hmm. So it wants to achieve economic prosperity and equality among the people, okay? In order to do that, it's going to engage in planning of the economy. So it's going to abolish private property in the means of production, substitute property prices and profit and loss accounting for collective ownership, government set prices, all right, and material balances within the industrial process, okay? But the reality is what that is, what produces that is that the economy ends up by producing less with more. The very definition of economic rationality is that we should be able to produce more with less.
Right.
But what the reality in the socialist economies was they had to produce, they produced less with more, which meant that they were getting poorer over time, right? Which it goes back to why it is they can't achieve their goals of prosperity and equality. So since they can't achieve that, and they can't achieve their goals, there's all this effort to be able to try to make the system work even when it can't work to achieve its goals. And so that opened up corruption, rent-seeking behavior, all this kind of soft budget constraints and the dysfunction that goes with all of that. And that's how these socialist systems operate. So the first thing that we know is when we study socialist reality is that these were all shortage economies.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so since they're shortage economies, that means that there's this giant queuing system, right, to line up. So one of the things we see is lines for bread, lines for toilet paper, you know, lines to get a car, you know, all these things like that, lines to get into the hospital, all the queuing system. And that's the reason for the source of the bribery, in the Soviet Union, Blatt means bribery, and the phrase used to be Blatt is higher than Stalin. So if I could offer bribes, I could, you know, that's even more important than Stalin. And so what you get in these shortage economies is you create the rents, because you're creating, when someone has to wait in a line to purchase a good, that creates costs to the buyer that are not simultaneously benefits to the seller.
Right.
Since the seller has control over the resource, it's in the seller's interest to turn those non-monetary costs in the monetary benefits for themselves.
Right.
And that creates a sort of the rent-seeking society. That rent-seeking society, in order to transition from it, you have to have what's called get over the transitional gains trap.
Right.
And so this becomes one of the number one puzzles of political economy when they transition. So how do you overcome this? Now, it's privatization doesn't do it alone. So Milton Friedman, when he first went to China in 1979, was asked, Professor Friedman, what should we do to reform our economy? And he said, privatize, privatize, privatize. In 2002, he's asked, Professor Friedman, would you change anything that you said in your privatize, privatize, privatize? He said, oh, yes, privatize, 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 provided there's a rule of law. The way Mart Law translates that, and you know, he was a Friedman, like a Friedman devotee. The way he translated Friedman's dictum was privatize, privatize, privatize became privatize institutions, privatize.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get the institutions, then you recognize that you have to solve a credibility problem, right? Because all the previous efforts at reform ended up by failing because they were not credibly committed to.
Right.
It was like, oh, you know, it's like the old phrase about getting bit by your dog, right? You know, once, you know, if you get bit once, you know, that's shame on the dog. If you get bit twice, shame on me, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to actually get a credible commitment that you're going to, the announced reforms are going to actually be upheld. Well, not only, but you can make credible commitments to a lot of things. You know, like I'm going to credibly commit to, you know, punch the next person in the face, and then someone comes and I punch him in the face. That doesn't do much to lead to mutually beneficial exchange. So what I need to do is I got to credibly commit that I'm going to trade rather than raid. So I'm going to trade rather than engage in raid, and I'm going to tie my hands so that I can't raid in order to signal to you that. And so now that means that my credible commitments have to have content. And where does that content come from? That content comes from our culture, because we can't just pick a content off the shelf. It has to fit with local culture. And this is why, you know, when you listen to North or any of the other ones, they talk about the de jure rules and the de facto rules, and how much the de facto rules matter for the de jure, you know, for the acceptance of the de jure rules. And it's that interaction effect. So what happens is this Estonian culture that's underlying and resistant to this effort at Russification, right? The Russian, you know, elimination of its culture is actually one that is more tied to individualism and other kinds of things like that. And so this is one of the things that you see. So at the end of our monograph, we actually say that one of the reasons why Estonia does so well is, in Marxist terms, is because Estonian superculture, superstructure, right, which is the sort of ideas and cultural belief systems in Estonia, are much more lend themselves to a kind of independent individualist economy and whatnot. And so going back to your history, that's a big question.
Right.
You know, how did they resist the czarist regime? How did they, you know, they're a small country that's in resistance against, you know, going all the way back, you know, to the, you know, Vikings or whatever, right? And so they're engaged in all of that. And that's part of the way they tell the story about themselves. So anyway, that's, yeah.
Yeah. And so that resistance, now I think we should talk about the singing revolution, because that's part of that resistance. Can you tell us about the singing revolution, what it was, when it happened?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. By the way, one of your classmates back at George Mason, when you guys were in the master's program, Olga, Olga is the first person to really get me thinking about the singing revolution. And she, one of her chapters in her dissertation is about the singing revolution, actually. I don't know if you knew that.
I don't think I did.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating story, because they had an annual musical festival, and the Russian authorities, right, Soviet authorities, So one of the first things to just back up is what you got to do is you got to look at these different places and see what languages they forced their young kids to learn. So I just was out for dinner last night with a family from Romania. And so you have the mom who's the same age as me. And then you have the kids, you know, which are like my kids' age. And then they have their little ones. And so they were talking about when they were in school, the kids like your generation. And I said, oh, what language did you learn? Because they all learn. They're not like in the U.S. here. They all had to learn multiple languages. Right. They said, oh, we learned French and English. And I said, how about when your mom, you know, was in school? And the mom's at the end of the table and she says, not English, that's for sure. And it was French and Russian, mm-hmm. right, is what they learned. And if you go to Estonia or Georgia or any of the other places, during the Soviet era, Russian was, you know, what all of these, and in fact, you know, Russians are very, you know, judgmental. So they mm-hmm. would be highly critical if you spoke, you know, say Russian with a Georgian accent, or, you know, he couldn't quite speak proper Russian, you know, kind of mm-hmm. thing. Which, you know, so Stalin, for example, is Georgian. And he part of his hatred of the intellectuals, which he had, was precisely because of this. He wasn't the same sort of same kind of culture as like Trotsky or something. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so they tried to, you know, what they called Russification, basically substitute for Estonian culture and history Russian. And that this is what you learn. So you're supposed to wear your traditional Russian outfit. You're going to sing Russian folk songs. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what's going to be celebrated at the music festival. We're all going to get together and we have this wonderful music festival and we're going to sing Russian songs and celebrate, you know, our history. And that's how they describe it. You know, our history, which is mm-hmm. Russian and everything. And so in the you know, 1980s, as the independence and the recognition of the Stalin-Hitler pact was, you know, illegitimate and there was more and more movement towards independence, what happened was the organizers, local organizers, decided they're going to pull a trick, basically. And so they sang Estonian folk songs and they all joined and they refused to back down in singing the and celebrating Estonian culture and it and its history. And this was to the great dismay, and as it got more and more dismay, it became stronger and stronger force, and it was an act of defiance and of nonviolent resistance in a major way, and it generated the independence movement.
And it went on for days and more yep. and more people joined.
Yeah. And eventually, you know, even they decided to have a handholding, you know, across, you know, the Baltic states, basically, you know, we were united against our oppressors, you know, and they, yeah. Now, again, you know, the world had changed. And so, like I said, you know, Gorbachev did send in, stormtroopers, you know, to, you know, go in there, they parachuted in, they, you know, suppress some of the groups, but it's, you know, basically most of the revolutions of 1989 were bloodless. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of, the system just kind of ceased to operate, ceased to hold. Only in Romania, you know, was it really, really violent, right? Where they had, mm-hmm. you know, shooting and everything in the streets. But if you look at like what happened in East Germany, you know, and again, in East Germany, Gorbachev was in East Germany with Honecker basically like a month before East Germany collapsed. And Honecker's approval ratings in the late summer of 1989 were like still off the charts, like 80% mm-hmm. approval rating, you know, which of course was all bogus. But he still had these huge approval ratings. But then what happened was once Hungary made its border porous, then what happens, everyone just started migrating all over the place. And then the expectation was, is Gorbachev would step in and stop it to defend, you know, the regimes. But keep in mind, that's what people's expectations were, because remember what happened in China in earlier that summer in 1989, that's when Tiananmen Square happened. Mm-hmm. And so the belief was, is that, you know, the tanks were going to come rolling in and crush the soul of these revolutions. And instead, you know, they just, you know, the autumn of, the, you know, the sort of autumn of nations just sort of took place. And it was amazing. And Estonia, of course, and Lithuania and Latvia are all part of that.
Now, what did Estonia, when they were transitioning to back to a market-based economy, did they have a particular strategy for this? And I know in the book you mentioned the Estonia just does it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, our book on Poland, you know, it's very clear that Balcerowicz had a plan. He's an economist. It's a very sophisticated sort of, you know, plan that links basically the Washington consensus, you know, in the context of the Polish example, and the consequences of that are amazing or whatever. In many ways, what happens in Estonia is just that they just are going to move quickly to the market. You know, it's like, you know, they're just going to, as we say in there, they're just going to do it. And by, and they didn't really, you know, I don't want to overstate things, which I'm kind of prone to doing here. But, you know, basically Mart Laar and others, Mart Laar's their first elected official, but, you know, the reform effort is going on already, right? So, but they just, it's not like, you know, they all read Milton Friedman and then they just said, we're going to do whatever Frieda Choose tells us to do or whatever. But in many ways, that's kind of like, we're just going to go. Like, we're just going to get, so communism's bad. What's the opposite? Let's just have that, you know, kind of thing. Now, you know, what we show in the book is that, you know, on issues like social spending and things like that, they just become a normal middle income, you know, country of, you know, Western Europe, right?
Right.
So they're just like all the other social democratic countries of Western Europe in terms of the level of social spending and the safety net and these kind of things like that. But that compared to where they came from is a radical shift.
Right.
So I don't want to, again, overstate that as well. But, you know, monetarily, fiscal policy, you know, basically take the economic freedom index, right? So the index that you work on. And so you have five issues, right? So you have basically, you know, your privatization, right? Regulation, macro, you know, monetary stability, fiscal responsibility, and trade.
Right.
Okay. And on those five components, they just jump in awful gone. And that's why they had the kind of level of economic freedom that they did. You know, and then with that came the sort of level of economic growth and development that you guys all measure all the time. And so that's how they ended up by catching up and, you know, catching up to Finland. So Finland had, you know, all those years, let's say, you know, 50, 60 years of a gap in which Finland, you know, could grow. And now you have this in a decade and they're like, you know, like going like this. And, you know, and again, you know, just look at other kind of measures. In Estonia, their life expectancy from 1994 into, you know, a decade later, they increased their, you know, life expectancy by 10 years. You know, like, so, you know, again, they went from 66 to 76. Now, Finland is still at what, 77 or whatever like that. But when they were at 66, Finland was up here on the trend line, right? And so it's you know, like we showed in Poland, the transition to these market economies lead the population to live more prosperous and longer living lives. And in this volume, we also track happiness measures. And we look at Estonia on happiness measures. And Estonia actually does better than the other transition economies, you know, in terms of this. So, you know, I many, many years ago, I went to a talk by Albert Hirschman, the great social scientist, called Industrialization and Its Discontents. And what he did was he studied industrialization in the North, South, East, and West. And he basically studied it through memoirs and novels and things like that. And I'll never forget it. He says the one common thing between all industrialization periods is people kvetch. No one likes going through industrialization, which makes sense because the people who are writing are the elites.
Right.
And so the elites are actually having their position threatened or whatever. And so they didn't ask the sort of average person, do you like it that now you can get silk stockings? Whereas before only the princess could get them, you know, kind of thing. Right.
Right.
And so, but in Estonia, so most of us associate with transition periods, what they call this J curve thing, right? Things get worse before they get better or whatever. The Estonians belie that in the sense that they're just like, no, you know, we're better off. It's that, you know, we're happier, you know, we're living longer, we're more prosperous, you know, this is great. So, you know, we don't have to work as long to be able to get the same kind of things that, you know, we used to get, right? And so, again, going back to the basic economics of this, you know, the system has to be able to produce more with less. You know, you can boil down the whole economic calculation debate to that idea. What economic calculation allows us to do is sort from the array of technologically feasible projects those which are economically viable. That's what its job in the economy is to do. But the purpose of that sorting is to be able to produce more with less. And that's what's meant by the definition of economically rational. So when Lisa says things like, you know, a socialist economy must forego rationality, he doesn't mean that the people in a socialist economy can't like weigh their marginal benefits and marginal costs. It's that the outcome of all of these decision makers weighing their marginal benefits and their marginal costs will end up by leading them to producing outputs that cost them more to produce than the value of the output that they generate. And so that might be, you know, the issue.
All right. Well, we are about out of time. And so let's continue this conversation in episode 2.
Thanks for joining us for the Realities of Socialism podcast, where we take a deep dive into the consequences of socialism as it was imposed on tens of millions of people during the 20th century. For more information, including infographics, free books, and more podcast episodes, visit realitiesofsocialism.org.